Landmark ruling in Tanner versus United States, the Supreme Court held that after returning a verdict, jurors could not impeach or invalidate that verdict by taking the witness stand and saying that jurors were getting drunk and getting high during the trial and jury deliberations. Writing for the court, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor stated that there is little doubt the post-verdict investigation into juror misconduct would in some instances lead to the invalidation of verdicts reached after irresponsible or improper juror behavior. It is not at all clear, however, that the jury system could survive such efforts to perfect it. A couple of years ago, however, the Supreme Court revisited this issue when the rule against jury impeachment butted up against the right to an impartial jury, and specifically, the right to a jury free of racial bias. This issue has now been raised again due to a man who has quite possibly given the death penalty due to the fact that he's gay. And so, the question now becomes, does it make sense to protect defendants from discrimination based upon race, but not to protect defendants from discrimination based upon sexual orientation? Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog. This June, you may have read the same Intercept article as me. It was by Jordan Smith, and it was titled, "Jurors Thought a Gay Man Would Enjoy Prison. They sent him to death row instead. Will the Supreme Court intervene?" The answer to that question was no, and to understand it, we need to go all the way back to the 18th century. In 1785, there was a lawsuit in England between a plaintiff and a defendant. The jurors found for the plaintiff, with two jurors later coming forward and saying the jury was divided and therefore flipped a coin, either a half crown or a farthing. Because the coin landed on the plaintiff's side, the jury entered a verdict for the plaintiff. In a 60-page opinion, the esteemed English jurist Lord Mansfield found that the jurors couldn't impeach or invalidate their verdict. It wasn't that Lord Mansfield authorized the coin flipping by the jury. Instead, he found this was an extreme example of jury misconduct, meaning that the jurors' statements about this misconduct also couldn't be trusted and were an insufficient ground for impeaching the verdict. What became known as Mansfield's rule eventually found its way into court opinions in the U.S. and later became codified in Federal Rule of Evidence 606B. That rule says that jurors generally can't impeach their verdicts with two major exceptions. The first exception is the one we covered in the Joy Watkins case. It allows for jurors to testify about extraneous prejudicial information that may have influenced the jury's verdict. This includes jurors making unauthorized trips to the crime scene, or as in the Joy Watkins case, driving the route that the defendant allegedly drove to get to the crime scene and see if the timing worked. That's what happened with a juror in the Joy Watkins case, who was leaning toward a not guilty verdict before doing her own drive test based upon a misinterpretation of the cell tower pings. Here was Susan discussing the issue with Claire Gilbert of the Georgia Innocence Project.
Laura and I had to head off to the next witness interview I had scheduled, but on the way there, I gave Claire a call to update her on what I'd learned from juror number 8.
Hey, so I just spoke to and she was very thoughtful, very diligent, remembered a lot, like, and she kind of casually threw out a bit of a hurdle. Apparently that weekend, before they came back on Monday and convicted, she went out and did a drive test of her own, and it convinced her that the state's theory was plausible, and, Her words were, "I thought the only thing that the clowns did right was the cell phone evidence," because she understood clearly there was a huge problem with the cell phone stuff, like, so on the one hand, she thought they were clear about it. On the other, no one else in the jury, like other than one or two others, understood it. And I couldn't get them to talk about it. And she seemed very frustrated about how the cell phone stuff seemed like a huge deal to her. And the other jurors, as she put it, were stuck in a crime novel. But that weekend, she went, and she remembered, she's like, oh, she knew it was the Kingston Tower. She's like, there was a call made around the time of the murder, but it was on the Kingston Tower, but it was out far. But there was one little spot closer in, like one little spot you could connect, and that weekend I went and tested it to see, and I thought it was possible to get there, and she couldn't remember exactly where she'd driven or what route she tested, but she remembered a spot somewhere out there between Kingston and Cedartown.
The second exception covers improper outside influences on jury deliberations. Let's say that a friend of the defendant or the victim threatens a juror. That juror can testify about that threat, and the friend can then be prosecuted for making that threat. And as this clip from WCPO shows, the same applies to a friend who tries to bribe a juror.
New at 5, a man accused of trying to bribe a juror with thousands of dollars. Hamilton County Prosecutor Joe Dieter says that man was trying to help a drug offender. 9 on Your Side's Roseanne Aragon joins us live outside the Hamilton County Courthouse tonight with what that man will now face as a result. Roseanne?
Craig, investigators say it was this man's close friend who was on trial, and they say he went through two extreme lengths to sway the jury and the evidence in his favor.
33-year-old Daryl Bullocks is now charged with bribery, obstructing justice, and attempting to tamper with evidence. His alleged crime, attempting to bribe a juror's husband with $10,000 in exchange for his wife's vote in his friend's favor. That friend is Jamar Hamilton. He stood trial last year for a major drug bust. He was indicted for trafficking 250 grams of heroin, having cocaine, a weapon under disability, as well as trying to disguise himself from police. Now Bullocks is facing charges for jury tampering. Not only that, when questioned by police, they say he tried to hit the erase button. Prosecutor Dieter stated, "Juries are the foundation of our justice system. I cannot overstate how important it is that juries remain above reproach."
Now Dieters did say that the juror did the right thing in telling the courts. Now if this man is convicted of all of the charges, he could face up to 7.5 years in prison. Reporting live, Roseanne Aragon, 9 on Your Side.
Conversely, if the jurors themselves engage in misconduct other than seeking out evidence not presented in the courtroom, there can't be jury impeachment. So if juror number 6 threatened juror number 8's life if she didn't change her vote from not guilty to guilty, there couldn't be jury impeachment. There also couldn't be jury impeachment in the case of a compromise verdict in which the jury finds a defendant guilty of some charges as a compromise between jurors who would have found him guilty on all charges and other jurors who would have found him not guilty on all charges. As this clip from the Today Show makes clear, this is what happened in the Stephen Avery case from Making a Murderer.
Joining us again, in our last hour, you were speaking about a juror in the case where Stephen Avery was convicted of murder, and that juror now has a big revelation. What can you tell us about that?
Sure. The juror contacted us directly and told us that the verdicts in Stephen's trial were a compromise. That was the actual word the juror used, and went on to describe the jurors ultimately trading votes in the jury room and explicitly discussing, if you vote guilty on this count, I will vote not guilty on this count. So that was a significant revelation.
That's a very serious charge, obviously more one that could turn this case on its head. Have you been able?
But of course, the allegation didn't turn the case on its head because the juror wasn't able to testify about this compromise verdict. And there are reasons why this testimony about matters internal to the jury deliberation process is generally inadmissible. Preserves the finality of verdicts. Means that jurors can deliberate openly and honestly without fear that what they say will be aired in open court. And most importantly, means that jurors can't be threatened, harassed, or bribed by the losing party to claim there was some type of jury misconduct. But what about when there's clear evidence of egregious jury misconduct? In the 1987 Supreme Court case Tanner v. United States, jurors alleged that jury deliberations were one big frat party. Here was one of the issues facing the court.
Secondly, whether sworn affidavit that jurors were consuming large amounts of alcohol, were utilizing and dealing in marijuana, and were ingesting cocaine throughout the course of a complex criminal proceeding required an evidentiary hearing in order to make a determination as to whether these jurors were rendered incompetent to consider and decide the case in violation of their Sixth Amendment rights.
Bombas is totally re-engineered socks with comfort innovations that add up to one way more comfortable pair of socks. 2 years of research and development led to multiple improvements to the sock design, performance, and comfort. These include an arch support system that provides extra support where you need it most, a cushioned footbed that's reinforced for comfort without added bulkiness, a seamless toe, super soft cotton, and finally, and most importantly for me, stay-up technology. 133 tension levels were tested to find the perfect tension that's comfortable, stays in place while not being too loose, and never leaves a mark. This is what I've always hated about socks. They're always too loose to stay up or too tight in my ankles. But Bombas has been a game changer with a Goldilocks fit of its socks that has made wearing them a pleasure. Plus, by wearing Bombas, you're giving back. Socks are the number one most requested item in homeless shelters. That's why Bombas donates one brand new pair of socks for every pair they sell. To date, they've sold and donated over 9 million pairs. And now you, as listeners, can go to bombas.com/undisclosed. That's BOMBAS.com, and you'll get 20% off your first order. That's bombas.com/undisclosed and use the code undisclosed. Here was the key back and forth in the case between Justice Thurgood Marshall and Richard Lazarus for the Solicitor General.
Extrinsic prejudicial information.
Would you concede cocaine to be an outside influence?
No, we would not, any more than we would believe that anything that a juror voluntarily ate for breakfast, lunch, or dinner would be an outside influence.
Bacon and eggs and cocaine.
In each case, though, and we think this is the critical issue, in each case, it is an action voluntarily taken by the juror, him or herself, and not an action by an outsider taken, calculated to influence the juror's decision to assent or dissent from a verdict. And that's a very big difference, because you would have, if the first thing would be outside influence, then there could be investigations and inquiry into the personal habits and lives of jurors, and indeed losing parties in cases who had every incentive to undertake
this. This isn't personal habit. This is what you did in the jury room under the jurisdiction of the court and with the imprimatur of the court on it. And I can't see you putting the imprimatur of the court on cocaine.
Justice Marshall would ultimately find that the right to a competent jury trumped Rule 606B, but he was part of the dissent in Tanner, which held that if we deny the defendants this opportunity, the jury system may survive, but the constitutional guarantee on which it is based will become meaningless. Meanwhile, the majority opinion held that even evidence of extreme drug and alcohol use and abuse by jurors did not allow for jury impeachment. Next, fast forward 22 years, and you have the case of Kerry Dean Benally. Benally, a Native American man, was charged with assault on a federal officer. After he was convicted, a juror came forward and said that the jury foreman had said, "When Indians get alcohol, they all get drunk, and that when they do get drunk, they get wild or violent." According to the juror, a female juror then seemed to agree with the foreman, saying something about what happens when, quote, they get drunk. The juror also claimed that two other jurors talked about a need to send a message to the reservation. While Tanner held that the right to a competent jury didn't trump Rule 606B, did the same reasoning apply to the right to an impartial jury? I didn't think so, and so I ended up writing the amicus curiae or friend of the court brief on behalf of evidence professors, asking the Supreme Court to hear the case. Back in 2009, the Supreme Court declined the invitation, but 7 years later, the Supreme Court eventually agreed to hear a similar case. In Pena Rodriguez v. Colorado, a Hispanic man was convicted of sexual assault, and it later came to light that a juror had made comments such as, quote, "I think he did it because he's Mexican, and Mexican men take whatever they want." Presented with these facts, the court finally found that the right to an impartial jury does trump Rule 606B and allow for jury impeachment when there is evidence of racial bias by jurors during deliberations. Here's Justice Kennedy issuing the opinion of the court.
While the court did not permit an exception to the bar on juror testimony in that case, it did say that there may be need for an exception in the case of juror bias so extreme that almost by definition the jury trial right has been abridged. Today, the court must ask whether, as a constitutional matter, that exception is applicable here. It must become the heritage of our nation to rise above racial classifications that are so inconsistent with our commitment to the equal dignity of all persons, and this imperative to purge racial prejudice from the administration of justice was given new force and direction by the ratification of the Civil War amendments to the Constitution. Time and again, this court has been called upon to enforce the Constitution's guarantee against state-sponsored racial discrimination in the jury system. The unmistakable principle of these precedents is that discrimination on the basis of race is especially pernicious in the administration of justice. It damages both the fact and the perception of the jury's role as a vital check against the wrongful exercise of power by the state. So today's case lies at the intersection of two lines of this court's decisions, one endorsing the no impeachment rule, the other seeking to eliminate racial bias in the jury system. Those lines of precedent need not conflict. Racial bias, unlike the conduct at issue in Tanner or Werger, implicates unique historical, constitutional, and institutional concerns. Racial bias is a familiar and recurring evil. If left unaddressed, it risks systemic injury to the administration of justice. For these and other reasons, the court now holds that where a juror makes a clear statement that indicates he or she relied on a racial stereotype or animus to convict a criminal defendant, the Sixth Amendment requires that the no impeachment rule give way. This will permit the
Now, some of the wording used by Justice Kennedy in the court's opinion and its announcement focused specifically on the issue of racial bias and its unique history in this country. And that's left the question of whether the constitutional right to jury impeachment recognized in Peña-Rodriguez extends to evidence of other bias during jury deliberations, including anti-gay bias. This takes us to the case referenced in the introduction involving Charles Rines out of South Dakota. I recently spoke to his attorneys working on the case. I'm joined here today by Sean Nolan and Ria Tobacco Marr to talk about the Charles Rines case. And Sean, what's your position?
So I'm the head of the Capital Habeas Unit in the Federal Community Defender Office for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania. Basically, we're the federal public defenders in Philadelphia, and we have a specialized unit that does capital post-conviction cases.
Okay. And Ria, how about yourself?
I'm a senior staff attorney with the ACLU in our national office. I work on LGBT and HIV issues around the country.
Okay. And so if we go back to 1993, what were the facts of this case that led to the conviction of Mr. Rines?
Mr. Rines went into an unoccupied donut shop at night to commit a burglary. And at the time he was there committing the burglary, he was surprised by an employee who showed up unexpectedly. Mr. Rines was convicted of killing that employee and sentenced to death. He was about 36 years old at the time. After he was arrested, Mr. Rines immediately admitted to the crime. During the time of the trial was set, he offered to plead guilty for life. That was rejected, and he was tried by a jury and sentenced to death.
And so in between the conviction and the sentence in this case, the jurors send a note to the judge. And what does that note say?
Right. So the after the conclusion of the penalty phase, as you know, it's a two-phase proceeding where he's first convicted and then the jury determines whether or not he should be sentenced to death. After the conclusion of the penalty phase, the jury was in the middle of deliberations, and they sent a note out asking certain questions to the court. Those questions included things like, will Mr. Rines be able to mix with the general population? Will he be jailed alone? Will he have a cellmate? Will he be allowed to marry or have conjugal visits? They asked if he would be allowed to brag about his crime, especially to new and young men jailed for lesser crimes. They asked if he would be able to create a group of followers or admirers. So these were questions that implicated implicated the question of gay bias in their deliberation.
Right, and then if we fast forward several years, we actually have jurors coming forward and indicating that anti-gay bias played what role in the deliberations?
Right, so we got involved in this case much more recently, and once we got involved in the case, we decided to go out and interview all the jurors and do comprehensive interviews. The Peña-Rodriguez case was pending at that point in the U.S. Supreme Court as well, which I'm sure we'll get to in a few minutes. But those jurors, basically, several of them signed declarations and that they knew Mr. Rines was a homosexual. They thought that he shouldn't be able to spend his life in prison with men. One of the jurors said, if he's gay, we'd be sending him where he wants to go for life without parole. Jurors talked about the fact that he was gay was jurors called it disgusting, and talked about the fact that this is a farming community and they don't approve of that kind of a thing. So this is the evidence that came out much later.
And Ria, in your work, how often have you seen cases where jurors are interviewed after the fact and there are indications that anti-gay bias might have played a role in either the verdict or the sentence?
Well, Colin, we know from surveys of court users that LGBT people experience a high degree of bias in the courtroom, regardless of the role they're playing, whether they're litigants or even when serving as jurors, which is all highly disturbing. Of course, when that bias is actually used to sentence someone to death, which is what may have happened to Mr. Rines, that is even more disturbing. There was a case last year where the Florida Supreme Court actually reversed the denial of post-conviction relief to a man who was sentenced to death by a jury that included a juror who had made explicit anti-gay statements. In that case, the statements had actually come up during voir dire and not after the fact. But we know this is not the only case where anti-gay bias is playing a role either in the conviction or the sentence. And of course, when it's the death penalty we're talking about, we want to be absolutely sure that bias based on sexual orientation is not involved.
Do you have trouble sleeping? And then when you get up, do you have trouble focusing and getting a good start to the day? These are both big issues for me, which is why I find the Calm reflection of both the start and end of the day is so important. And that's why I'm excited that we've partnered with Calm, the number one app for sleep, meditation, and relaxation. It was even named Apple's 2017 App of the Year. If you head to calm.com/undisclosed, you'll get 25% off a Calm premium subscription, which includes hundreds of hours of programming, including one, Calm guided meditations on issues like anxiety, stress, and focus, including a brand new meditation each day called the Daily Calm, and two, sleep stories, which are like bedtime stories for adults. Calm has over 100 of these soothing tales read by well-known voices to help people unwind and fall into a deep sleep. For a limited time, Undisclosed listeners can get 25% off of a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/undisclosed. It includes unlimited access to all of Calm's amazing content. Get started today at calm.com/undisclosed. That's calm.com/undisclosed. Right. And so then, Sean, in this case, as you said, you've gotten these juror statements, and we have this federal rule and state counterparts, Rule of Evidence 606B, that says generally jurors cannot impeach or call into question the validity of a verdict based upon anything internal to the jury deliberation process. And traditionally and historically, that would include bias expressed by jurors. But then we have this Pena-Rodriguez case out of Colorado where the Supreme Court recognizes that rule has to give way to the right to an impartial jury. And so then that forms the basis of trying to get these juror statements into evidence, right?
That's right. That's exactly what we've been arguing.
And the response by South Dakota is what?
Well, they have said a few things. They have said that really mostly they're relying on 606B to say that this should not come in, but they've also said very clearly that anti-gay bias is not covered by Pena-Rodriguez, that this is a different thing. And in fact, the South Dakota Supreme Court agreed with that.
Right, and so essentially the state of South Dakota in prosecuting this case and defending the verdict, as well as the Supreme Court of South Dakota, is saying even though Pena-Rodriguez says we're allowed to have jurors testify about racial bias during deliberations, we're not allowed to have jurors testify about anti-gay bias.
That's right.
And so from a legal perspective, Sean, what's your take on those conclusions?
Well, I mean, you know, our position is that anti-gay bias is just like racial bias. It's longstanding in the country, longstanding in our jurisprudence, unfortunately. And that also that since death is different, that this is certainly an exception to that 606B rule. You know, for years in the last century, gay people couldn't be married, certainly. They were prohibited from government, employee, and military service, and all kinds of things. So this stuff has been going on for a long time. And now we get to this situation where the Supreme Court has plainly said racial bias cannot be used during jury deliberations. And certainly it seems clear that anti-gay bias should also not be used in jury deliberations. And the fact that Mr. Rhines was sentenced to death on that basis is just outrageous.
And Rhea, I know that you wrote a brief on this issue, so I'm quoting from the state of South Dakota. No politician has ever proposed constructing a wall to keep homosexuals out of the country. No civil war has been fought over sexual orientation. And they sort of go on and on and say anti-gay bias is, I guess, of a lower level than racial bias. And so what was the argument that you made in your brief in terms of addressing this argument?
Well, I think the state's argument really boils down to the notion that race is different. And on some level, of course, that's true. The history of race discrimination in America is unique. On the other hand, that doesn't mean that other forms of oppression are any less odious or that the courts have to stand by and allow other forms of discrimination to go unchecked, which is essentially what the state is arguing. And as Sean described earlier, you know, our nation has a long and painful history of discrimination based on sexual orientation. And, you know, I smile at the quote about no politician has ever, vowed to construct a wall, because, of course, they didn't have to. Congress did that, and in the Immigration and Nationality Act. And until 1990, gay people actually were barred even from entering this country. So I do think that very long and painful history is there that warrants a serious inquiry into whether anti-gay bias played a role in the decision to sentence Mr. Rice to death.
If you've met me in real life, you might have noticed something about me in a good way, and that is that I smell pretty good. I'm not just making this up. There are other podcasters who talk about it. This is a specific shout out to Patrick and Jillian from True Crime Obsessed, who I think every other episode talk about how I smell, and there's a reason for that. I love perfume. I'm not naturally scented beautifully, okay? I love, love, love my perfumes. I collect perfumes. And that's why I am so, so excited about one of our newest sponsors. I'm talking about Scentbird, a luxury perfume subscription service. I mean, literally, it's like the stuff of my dreams. You get to choose a new scent every single month. They've got over 500 designer brands, and it's only $14.95 a month. What they do is you pick out every month your scent, and for $14.95, they send you a travel size spray. You get 130 sprays out of it. It lasts you for a month. Now, the reason I love this, number one, is because this way I get to try lots of different perfumes. And one of the secrets, and I actually had to discuss this on a message board for True Crime Obsessed about why do I smell good, is because I like to mix my perfumes. I like to layer them. I'm usually wearing two or three different scents at a time. And Scentbird is, that's, I mean, it's like a godsend. I can do exactly that. Also, I travel so much. This is perfect, a travel size spray. I'm so excited. My first shipment is coming in soon. I went in and I picked the ones I wanted. All these perfumes that I love, the brands that I normally use. And because you don't have to buy a big old jug of perfume a lot of times, which, I mean, be honest, we rarely does any woman get through an entire, or even man get through an entire bottle of perfume. You're not wasting anything. Other times when I'm like, I want to buy some new perfume, but then I feel guilty because I've got like these, you know, those big old full-size perfume bottles sitting on my dresser and in my dresser, like that still have like halfway full or a third of the way full. No more guilt. I'm just gonna use these travel sizes. I mean, 130 sprays, that is amazing. I mean, that's a whole month's worth of perfume for $14.95. The shipment that's coming to me right now, is gonna have one of my favorites. It is Narciso Rodriguez For Her. I love the way this thing smells. Okay, this is one of the perfumes, by the way, that I did use all the way down to the very last squirt squeeze. I still have the bottle because once in a while I like to just like sniff it, but I was so excited that Scentbird carried it. They have, I mean, like just all the top brands. So you guys can check it out and you can smell as good as me. And remember, layer, use more than one perfume. All you gotta do is go to scentbird.com/undisclosed and pick out your first perfume today, and you'll get 50% off if you use my code undisclosed, all right? So you get your first perfume for not $14.95, but for $7.50 and free shipping. So check out this deal today. Go to scentbird.com. Once again, it's scentbird.com/undisclosed. Use my code undisclosed, get 50% off your first month, and have fun dating a perfume before you commit to it forever.
Yeah, and it seems to me, I would be curious in the thoughts on this of either of you, is it seems to me, at least in terms of the sentencing decision of life versus death, I mean, racial bias, I suppose, could play an attenuated role in deciding to give the death penalty based upon generalized racial bias. But in this case, at least my understanding of the facts is very much that they're saying that sexuality in this case played a role very directly in deciding to give the death penalty as opposed to a life sentence.
That's right. If I can start, I mean, Peña Rodriguez was not a death case, and this one is. So certainly, you know, the courts have said over and over that death is different. And so that's why it should be considered. But the jury very clearly acknowledged these things when they said, oh, if he gets life, he's going to have too much fun in prison. I mean, that's the concept that's getting out there. And that's just outrageous. I mean, making that consideration is plainly using his sexual orientation to give him the death penalty. It seems very clear to us.
I agree with that. And just to add, I mean, you quoted some of the juror statements earlier, Colin, but these statements, I think, really speak for themselves. You have a juror saying that the jury, while deliberating whether to sentence Mr. Rines to life in prison without parole or to death, saying, if he's gay, we'd be sending him where he wants to go. That is just outrageous, and it's based on the pernicious stereotype that somehow gay people are sexual predators or would enjoy being in prison for life. Another juror said that there was disgust about the fact that Mr. Rines was gay. So that sort of disapproval about who someone is and who they choose to love, just outrageous to think it could play a role in whether or not someone lives or dies.
And Sean, in terms of the legal status of this, I know there's been a lot of news that's been floating around, and I think there are several different tiers of appeal in this case that are going on. Can you sort of update us on the status of where exactly the case stands and what the potential future of the case is?
Yes. Yeah, so just recently, we lost our request for a certificate of appealability in the Eighth Circuit. There was actually a dissent. So as you know about certificates of appealability, it's about whether jurors can disagree. So certainly that tells us that jurors can disagree. So we're probably going to go back there and ask for a panel rehearing in the Eighth Circuit. If that is denied, then we're going to the United States Supreme Court on this issue.
And has there been any thought about, is it the governor in South Dakota who could potentially commute the sentence from a death sentence to a life sentence? Has there been any thought about approaching him about a commutation here?
Yes, actually, we've talked a lot about that, and that is something that we will eventually do if we are not successful in these other efforts.
And we often like to call on our listeners to assist and help in any way they can. Would the best way for our listeners to play a role in this be to call or contact the governor? Are there any other ways that listeners might be able to assist in this effort?
Well, in past times when we've done clemency efforts, we've had a lot of public support at times, and that can be very helpful. We have not gotten to the point where we figured out exactly how we're going to go about that because we still have these very strong litigation avenues to go. But certainly, if folks reach out to us, we can put people in the right direction of how they can assist.
All right, great. Well, Sean or Rhea, do either of you have any additional thoughts you'd like to share on the case or the evidentiary issue that's presented here?
You know, I don't know. I just want to say that this type of situation really erodes confidence, you know, in our jury system and in our judicial system. And that's why we're, you know, hopeful that the courts are going to correct this.
I would just add, you know, Chief Justice Roberts, not known for being one of the most progressive members of the court, commented last year in a case involving race discrimination in sentencing that when bias plays a role in the decision whether or not to sentence someone to life or death, that is, in his words, a disturbing departure from the basic premise of our criminal justice system, that our law punishes people for what they do, not who they are. And I think the evidence in Mr. Rines' case really challenges that basic premise.
All right. Well, Sean and Rhea, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today. I really appreciate it. We'll continue to update you on the status of the Charles Rines case, and I've agreed to file an amicus brief in the case in the event that the Eighth Circuit of the Supreme Court agrees to hear it. Thanks for listening to this special episode of Undisclosed. We'll be back on Thursday with another special episode. I'd like to thank the following people: Hannah McCarthy for editing, Christy Williams for website management, Baluki for our logo design, and Mital Telhan, our executive producer. I'd like to thank our sponsors. Promotional details for our sponsors are in the show notes and on our website under the new sponsor page. The credit song you're hearing is Lead Belly's Gallows Pole. As always, you can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram using the handle @UndisclosedPod. And finally, you can become a patron and get access to additional content by going to patreon.com/undisclosed. What did you bring me? You follow God's pole. Gonna blow.